The author meets the critics. Welcome to The Author Meets the Critics, where best-selling authors and their severest critics, the nation's top book reviewers, meet each other in a literary free-for-all, informal, unrehearsed, catch-as-catch-can. And now meet the man who keeps the peace on these programs, your regular chairman, John K. M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. Our author today is one of America's outstanding industrial leaders, General Robert Wood Johnson, who during the war served as an officer in the United States Army Ordnance and as vice chairman of the War Production Board and chairman of the Smaller War Plants Corporation. General Johnson has devoted a lifetime to industry, government, and public affairs, and in his book, which is called Or Forfeit Freedom, he makes an eloquent plea for the preservation of the democratic system of private enterprise. General Johnson has a reputation for getting along with labor, and this afternoon we hope to put that reputation to the test. Our critics are two outstanding students of labor relations, James B. Carey, Secretary-Treasurer of the CIO, and Francis Downing, Eastern Educational Director for the United Auto Workers, a CIO affiliate. We expect a jurisdictional dispute, General Johnson, between Mr. Carey and Mr. Downing over your book. But before labor meets management, we would like to introduce our author of the afternoon to tell, in his own words, the thesis of his book, General Robert Wood Johnson.
Some reviewers have called Our Forfeit Freedom simplified economics. And some say it's labor relations with an economic slant. But neither statement quite tells what I set out to do. Like most Americans, I believe in our business system. In fact, I go so far as to say that America means business. And that business, in its modern sense, means America. But business has got itself into deep trouble. To get out, it must chart a clear course. I've tried to set up some bearings for it in this little book. To get business going full speed ahead, we've got to set up objectives and decide what it must do. Too many people still think that business has just one purpose, that of earning a profit. Actually, the first and biggest job of American business is to make and distribute the things people need. And by this I mean enough to provide a decent living for every one of the 143 million Americans. The second job is to make it possible for American workers to live happy, useful, dignified lives. Unless these things are done, business and workers, too, will be headed for a dismal failure. Don't get me wrong. I'm not forgetting the hungry millions of Europe, the menace of atom bombs, or a lot of other problems. I merely say that business must do its big, its urgent jobs first, or lose its chance to tackle any of the others. If business loses its chance, you and I and Jim Jones at his lathe or Phil Press will lose most of the personal, political, and economic freedom that now makes his life worthwhile. With that will come a slump in morale and production that will smash our plans for decent living and aid to the rest of the world. And now, Mr. McCaffrey, bring on your critics.
All right, General Johnson, here they are. First, the Eastern Educational Director for the United Auto Workers of America, Mr. Francis Downing.
Mr. Johnson, it seems to me, has written a disappointing and unrealistic book. The book is saturated with goodwill, but it never comes to grips with essential conditions of freedom.
Well, there, General Johnson, is the opposition. On the other side of the fence, with a different opinion of your book, Or Forfeit Freedom, is the Secretary-Treasurer of the CIO, Mr. James B. Carey.
I am happy to appear on the favorable side of General Johnson's book, Or Forfeit Freedom. That means that I endorse the book. I do not endorse it with reservations, such as I usually have with regard to a book written by a businessman. General Johnson is a good businessman, and he is a successful businessman. Of course, in writing this book, he has forever forfeited his freedom to become the president of the National Association of Manufacturers. General Johnson's book is of such great value because it portrays domestically, in the field of industrial relations, the part our country as a whole must play internationally. His book is the answer to Vyshinsky. His book is the answer to Taft and Hartley. Yes, his book is the answer to those that believe in suppression. Internationally, we must recognize the dignity of the human person. And General Johnson gives us a formula, which we could well follow here at home. His book has been called by one reviewer, almost radical. I go a step farther. It is a radical book. It calls for the radical procedures of the democratic process. It gets down to the roots of things. We need more of that radicalism these days.
Now, Mr. Downing, you're faced here with a very wholehearted endorsement of this book from a man who works with you. You're on the same side of the fence. What do you think about Mr. Carey's enthusiasm?
Mr. Carey's enthusiasm baffles me a little bit because he said himself that he's committed to this book without reservations. One of the statements in Mr. Johnson's book, which is a counsel of perfection, I submit, to big business, is that they avoid the evils of monopoly. This is a quotation, and great size. And he spends a good deal of his time, apart from the suggestions for a training program to big business, in dealing with the fact that there is size in business in America. And it worries him a great deal, and it sincerely and honestly worries him. But when I suggest that his book doesn't come to grips with freedom, I don't see how you can unreservedly commit yourself to a book which simply makes that form a verbal incantation. The fact is that prices in America at the present moment, against which we are all fighting, so high in terms of corporation profits, those prices are administered, and a large element of that price structure administered by monopoly corporation. During the war, even, corporations developed at the very period when we were supposed to be maintaining a war for freedom. Mr. Johnson never deals, although he has a chapter on prices, and although the very first sentence in that book is that he who controls prices controls the economic throttle. Yet the fact is that in a time right now, when prices are so great that everybody is very seriously worried about the character of inflation, how far it is going to go, about the relation between prices and controlled lack of supply by, for example, United States Steel, Mr. Johnson never touches that. I think also that I'm surprised a little at Jim Carrey with his unreserved approval of this book, because there runs as a kind of strange leitmotif, a thread through this book on the part of Mr. Johnson, perhaps because he worked for them once, two things. First of all, a curious fear of government. And second, it seems to me that he does not stress, in many places even mention, what seems to me the right role between government and industry and farmers and labor in the United States. Well, that's the essence of my objection to this book.
You've got enough to get your teeth into there, Mr. Carey.
Mr. Downing, you'll agree that the projection made by General Johnson in his book does not exist today. It is a hope for the future. He sets forth a clear-cut program. He does, in my opinion, attack prices in a way that has never been attacked by an employer before. He takes opposition to monopoly practices. He talks about the social role of prices and how the people that manage our economy should determine prices based on what will benefit the consumers. And he states very clearly in the language of labor that we must do something about our present situation. I think General Johnson in his book declares that prices are much too high, that prices must come down so that the people that make these goods must be able to purchase them. I think his language, although it's new and not in the usual formula and dogma that men of industry write their pamphlets, it sets forth very clearly what every employer of this country should recognize as the needs of our economy at this time, to reduce prices and thereby enlarge the market and give everyone an opportunity to have a better home. Yes, to live better. And I think he has the seed, certainly the key to our present problem.
Well, now I'm interested in the position of both you gentlemen on this program, since you both work for the CIO, and if you're searching for a leitmotif, as Mr. Downing was, I wonder about the leitmotif of our business troubles recently, which runs throughout the book, that certainly, he says, management troubles, but then there are always strikes, and there was the citation more than once throughout the book of 110 million man-hours lost during strikes. I can remember during the war that the Labor Bureau gave out statistics which were probably the same, but they read a little differently, and that they said that 0.5% of man hours were lost due to strikes. Now, there is a general blaming of labor for a lot of our troubles, but I have seen no attack on the book in that way at all from either of you.
Well, I think that I would agree that that exists in the book, and I was going to suggest that later on, as a matter of fact. What I'm trying to get rid of is the essence of the problem in the United States today is not solved by Mr. Johnson's blaming labor. As a matter of fact, Mr. Johnson, when he's on that subject, already commits labor not to ask for any more increases. It's not true, as Jim Carrey says, that there's anything unusual in Mr. Johnson's being a businessman and asking for a lowering of prices. Mr. Walker, who's the chief economist for Macy's, Strauss, and a whole group of people have been telling big business in this country for a long time that they're actually pricing themselves out of the market. Jim Carrey seems to be gripped by what he calls the language of labor. I don't know what that means, and it doesn't seem to me to be important. What is important is that there are high prices, and that Mr. Johnson does not deal with them except to ask business to bring prices down where they will be bought, where goods will be bought, in order that he can establish what he calls, and I agree with him on this, a community of service. But it isn't enough, and that Jim Carrey seems to me to miss. It isn't enough to ask people to raise or lower prices. Everybody in America has been asking the business to lower prices, and they don't do it. Here's the trick. Before CED, that's Mr. Norse's Committee of Economic Development, Mr. Voorhees, who's the chief economist for United States Steel, and Rufus Tucker, who's the chief economist for GM, actually said that they would not lower prices. And they would not lower prices because they expected a depression. And they admitted. And I would like to call this to Jim Carrey's attention, and especially Mr. Johnson's. They admitted that the wage increases we asked for in 1946 could have been absorbed, leaving United States Steel and General Motors handsome, the word is theirs, not mine, handsome profits, and still not increase prices. But they admitted that they did it, and they're going to continue to do it because they want dead money as a cushion against what they regard as a coming depression in the United States. Mr. Johnson doesn't touch that essential situation.
Well, since you wanted to call that to the particular attention of General Johnson, I think it's time to bring our author of the afternoon on and to present to our audience General Robert Wood Johnson, author of Or Forfeit Freedom.
The business of writing a book is rather new to me, and I was confronted with a series of problems. However, it was my purpose to create a state of mind, not to go into plans. I find business has been plagued with a plan idea for a generation. They want to buy a plan, pull it over like a blanket, and have it do a job. It never does. It's the state of mind that counts. And with the right state of mind, I think almost any plan will work. Without it, none will. You spoke of my fear of government. Yes, I have that fear. And you implied that perhaps having worked with government a long time, that's where I learned the fear, and you are correct. I have the utmost fear of government, without regard to its ideology or its in any partisan sense or its party. I do think government has a place in our economic zone, and that we will have to have cooperation between business and government. But government also needs reform, and plenty. I certainly didn't say that I can remember in the book that labor should take less. Perhaps you found that somewhere in somebody else's book.
No, I found that here.
But I don't remember ever saying it or implying it or thinking it.
It helps you, General Johnson. I couldn't find it in the book. And I think your activity in addition to your written word, you testified before the congressional committees in support of legislation to increase the minimum wage. I think your actions and as you demonstrate in your own plan give weight and content to what you wrote.
It's not just the words of an industrialist,
It's a man that practices what he preaches.
On the other hand, Mr. Carey, he did specifically say that any increase in wages meant an increase in prices.
That's right. He made two statements. I didn't say he was against not coming prices. He said that
I thought you did, General.
I think
well,
he did.
I didn't think he said that.
By the way, I want to say that I'm not arguing against Mr. Johnson or his past background. All I know about Mr. Johnson is what I've read in this book. And I admitted at the outset that his book, and obviously his personality, is saturated and dripping with goodwill. I have pointed out that the book is afraid of government, and he admits that.
Just a minute.
I have pointed out that now all of a sudden Mr. Johnson tells me personally, I can't handle these things in advance, that he's in favor of cooperation, but he still admits the fear, and he suggests government should be reformed. I'm all in favor of reforming the United States government.
I don't believe
that reform means abandonment by government of economics in the United States.
Well, I'm in favor of letting General Johnson cooperate here.
Brother Downing apparently thinks we have an overabundance of goodwill in this world, and a little bit more will do injury. I think the goodwill expressed in this book is a contribution to the great tension that exists in this country and in the world. In fact, everybody is jittery today. I think his book is a contribution to that. Yes, we have to deal with this practical thing. We have to know General Johnson, and we have to know what's behind his book. I could not find a reference in the book, as I read it, that said he was opposed to increases in wages. He did point out...
I didn't say he was opposed to increase in wages. I said that he's warned labor that they shouldn't ask for more increase in wages. No. And he also says somewhere in the book that there is such a relation between wages and prices that it seems to be his opinion that if you push wages up, you'll push up prices.
I want to get his opinion, gentlemen. I want to get General Johnson's opinion, and that's what it seems to be.
Nor do I think it. As a matter of fact, I think somewhere else, I pointed out that one of the best ways I knew towards reducing costs was to increase wages. Now, I think you can carry that idea to extreme and ridiculous limits when it won't work. But if there is one thing that stands out in the entire American economy, it is this fact, that we have increased wages and we have decreased costs, and every industrial engineer worth his salt knows how to do both.
Well, does that answer your question, Mr. Downing?
It answers my question in the sense that I accept Mr. Johnson's position as he now says it is. But still, I would like to ask Mr. Johnson this. For example, I was going to say before I was interrupted, by the way, I'm all in favor of Mr. Johnson's goodwill. I'm not against it any more than I'm in favor of sin. But I feel that there's some relationship between Mr. Johnson being opposed to sin and doing very much about it. I would like to ask him this. I think right now, for example, that as a minimum, and I'm willing to go much further than this, as a minimum, that allocation of materials that are in what government calls in business short supply, particularly steel, ought in this present crisis to be controlled by government. Would you be in favor of that, General Johnson?
Well, I'm rather in favor of a little sin once in a while, too, for that matter, but...
We all are, right. After hours.
So we get the record clear. I don't know. There's a certain inherent lack of competence in government procedure, particularly in a centralized sense. I like to see a group of men lay out a set of objectives. And if it can be executed on the local front in a cooperative sense, I'll buy it. If it's an edict from Washington, I used to write them, and I don't believe in them.
Well, General, as I read your book, it had something more than that in it. It said something that was worth saying. It said that if management and labor could get together and do the things that are necessary, it would be unnecessary for government to perform. It talked about that throughout the book, that these things can better be done in the economic field by management and labor, producing as much as they possibly can produce and distributing it in a proper manner, with reduced costs, yes, through high levels of production. And if we did the things as the people, it would not be necessary to rely on agencies of government.
It wasn't a fighting against government as an instrument. I think it's more presenting the program on the basis that the people ought to do these things for themselves, and they can do them. They have demonstrated through the war and in times of peace that they can perform.
Well, General Johnson, what mechanism would you use to control these things since you admit the necessity for control?
I don't admit the necessity for control. I do admit that we face a good many problems here. But let's get back to this thing that we call the key to economics, which is the pricer. You know, this may sound a little idealistic, but the man who approaches a price question with a service formula ends up with a different answer. In other words, if whenever he's actually setting and working a price, he puts first things first. Now, what is the first thing in a price? It's the customer. It's Mr. and Mrs. America. Because until that man buys the thing, there isn't a job for anyone. There's no one to pay the engineer or the pricer's salary. So that's first. If he'll go from the customer and work back to production costs, he'll make a better price. I say that's better than a formula.
General Johnson, did you write this sentence, which I'm quoting from 109, page 109 on the book? Nor can the individual wage earner always heed the sound argument that another round of wage increases will lead to still higher prices.
I'd like to see what's before and after. You know, this thing I wrote some time ago.
I'm going to be accused of quoting out of context
perhaps,
now.
Perhaps there's something in here that gives a different meaning.
I take it that you hadn't come across that statement either, Mr. Carey.
Yes, I have. And I think that is the popular notion, that if wages are increased, then the people that determine the price levels will increase the prices. And I asked Mr. Downing if that hasn't been so. If the people of this country have been educated to believe that the only way it can get a wage increase is by increasing prices. But that is not the formula or the proposal suggested by General Johnson.
I just read him the sentence.
In the book, but it's stated in the book as I recall reading it.
It's in the book, but I put it there.
No, there's no reason to try to distort the proposition.
All right.
Or to confuse it. It's in the book as a statement of things as they exist.
You originally maintained it wasn't in the book.
No, I did not. I says that General Johnson did not put forth a proposal that wages should not be increased.
I didn't
General,
say that he put forth
about the
contract. I'm not very proud of this paragraph as I look at it now, because it's pretty hard for me to remember what I did mean. But here's the point that this sentence was trying to say, and it's not the first one I've written that's confused me. Nor can the individual wage earner always heed the sound argument that another round of wage increases will lead to higher prices. Now, what I was trying to say there was that the wage earner can assume that frequently wages can be increased without increasing prices.
Yeah, but
that's what I meant to say.
That's what you meant to say. But what you actually say is that the argument is sound that increases in wages produce increases in prices. Now, how Jim Carrey can go along with that argument, I don't understand.
I remember.
But it seems to me, General Johnson, will you please...
Well, perhaps
I
better understood what General Johnson meant.
Well, now, I think at least, Mr. Carrey, we know what he meant on this particular thing, and that's cleared up, and it's cleared up to the satisfaction of all of us. I think, however, that there may be other fundamental disagreements between Mr. Downing and you and Mr. Downing and General Johnson, which General Johnson may want to comment on. General?
Well, I don't know that there are too many. I can see this, that I have exhibited at this council table here a fear of government more than I wrote in that book. I've enlarged on it. We might have an issue there. I think he also intimates that I've produced a manuscript that is flowing over with brightness and happiness and goodwill and doves flirting about on the roof. Well, no, I don't take goodwill that seriously, but I have been through this. When men sit around a table in an effort to find a solution to our modern problems, and they approach the table in complete antagonism, I see very little hope. I think we've got to change that spirit. at least to a moderate degree.
Well, Mr. Carey, that's where you come in.
Yes, I think if we changed some of the agencies of government, I have special reference to the 80th Congress, there'd be less reason for General Johnson to fear it. I think the 80th Congress, by and large, represents a point of view that's quite in conflict with the views of General Johnson. The 80th Congress primarily represents the prevailing views among the National Association of Manufacturers. And that's essentially the difference between General Johnson's point of view and the point of view of the Congress that's now or will soon be in session. They're not thinking in terms of the dignity of human beings. They're not thinking in terms of performing as a responsive government should perform to aid the people meet their problems, but they're creating obstacles to the people meeting their own problems as they should in a democratic process.
General, would you care to comment on the 80th Congress?
I certainly would not. I'm all finished commenting on that and any other Congress. I've worked with them a lot, and now I'm back home tending to my own knitting.
Well, and that must give you satisfaction. I feel that the point of cooperation is certainly an important one, and we would not like to imply at any point on The Author Meets the Critics that dissension was our sole purpose. Our purpose is dissension, which will wind up in some kind of cooperation. However, I wondered from time to time as I was going through the book, if these problems come up, are the unions going to settle them, or is management going to settle them, or are labor management committees going to settle them? And if so, what disposition on the part of management is there to accept a labor management committee as far as cooperation is concerned?
Well, I hope and believe it's increasing. I've seen a great many changes in the past 10 years. You ask who will settle it. I say unions and managements jointly will settle those things.
Will that be the mechanism that they will use?
I certainly feel it will, increasingly.
I remember that at the time that Walter Reuther first suggested them, there was a great deal of opposition from management and talk that this was taking over the problems of management on the part of unions. Do you believe that that will be a result of the labor management?
For my money, a portion of management's responsibilities should be shared with and accepted by the modern working technician.
Well, I hope that that's the kind of cooperation will result, and I hope that your ideas do prevail, General Johnson. And now, here's Bob Sherry to give you a preview of our next book on The Author Meets the Critics.
Next week's guest author will be the hard-hitting columnist of the Scripps Howard newspapers, Mr. Robert C. Rourke. Mr. Rourke has written a new book, an historical novel, which is intended to put an end to all historical novels. The title, Grenadine Etching. We can't promise General Lee or Frank Sinatra as the critics next week, but there'll be a lively battle, you may be certain, when Robert C. Rourke meets the critics. And now back to Mr. McCaffrey.
By proclamation of the President of the United States, this week has been designated as National Employ the Physically Handicapped Week. In order to create a greater awareness of the necessity for employment of rehabilitated, physically handicapped people, The Author Meets the Critics is pleased to present Mr. Irving Peltz, National Service Officer of the Disabled American Veterans, himself a disabled veteran of Anzio Beachhead, and one of the authors of The Purple Testament, Mr. Irving Peltz.
There are approximately 2 million disabled veterans in the United States. These men are not looking for charity, nor do they want any special favors. What they do want is an opportunity to use their special skills, to hold down the jobs, which they can, in many cases, do better than other workers. Studies by the Department of Labor during the war, show that when disabled workers are properly matched with the physical demands of their jobs, they have low turnover rates, low absenteeism rates, and low efficiency rates. Remember, it's not a worker's disabilities that count, it's his abilities. So hire handicapped workers during National Employ the Physically Handicapped Week, and all the time.
Thank you, Mr. Peltz. Before closing, I'd like to thank General Robert Wood Johnson for coming here to discuss his new book, Or Forfeit Freedom.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
WNBC, New York. It is now 5 p.m.